you're running in the system, sort of against the system.
Yeah, that's a wonderful point, though. And in all honesty, I surprised myself. In all honesty, I surprised my magnificent wife, Anahita Madavi West. Why? Because I've always viewed myself as part of a prophetic tradition that brings critique to bear on unjust status quos and tries to empower poor and working people wherever they are. But what has happened in the last couple of years is that we haven't had voices on the inside that have in any way tried to speak to poor and working people. So I decided to do what? Become head of the American empire in order to dismantle the American empire and empower poor and working people around the world. And my candidacy, my brother, is just a moment in a larger global movement, increasing voices from around the world, every corner of the globe, calling for policies that would accent their dignity. And so in that sense, it's quite continuous with my own prophetic sensibility. It's just that you're right. Now I'm going inside in order to dismantle, to ensure that those resources available there can be made much more available to poor and working people.
How do you feel your message is being heard? You know, I remember, 20 years ago, I worked closely and professionally with Dr. Chalmers Johnson. Chalmers wrote the book called Blowback, The Costs and Consequences of American Empire. It became the toughest to get book after the Iraq war, our invasion of Iraq occurred. And he made similar arguments. And he was a powerful white scholar from UC Berkeley who had moved to UC San Diego, commenting that the tensions about American militarism and American military engagement were going to chew up the fabric of society internally. And I'm interested in your own observations about that and how you get from where we are today to the kind of world where you think there's going to be much more justice and equity. Because it seems to me, if you're right, it's going to be a horribly messy process.
Well, one, it's already messy in terms of the deaths that could be on the West Bank, where you've got so many precious Palestinians being crushed by barbaric Israeli defense forces. And yet at the same time, you've got peasants in Brazil. At the same time, you've got workers in Uganda. At the same time, you've got Dalits in India or Muslims in China who are not being treated right. And it's just a matter of trying to not hate anybody, but to hate injustice. Chalmers Johnson was a great truth teller. He was cutting radically against the grain. He was cutting radically against those scholars who were coming up with rationalizations of American imperial power. So he became a prophetic figure, very much like C. Wright Mills or W.B. Du Bois or Toni Morrison, trying to tell the truth. But it's already messy. It's already ugly. It's already violent. The question is, how do we come to terms with that messiness, that violence, in such a way that we can accent the best in each and every one of us?
I listened recently to an interview you did with the Black Agenda Report, which I found very, very interesting and illuminating. And one of the other surprises for me in that was your enthusiasm, frankly, for wanting to go into Trump country and your thought that there will be a lot of Trumpists that are now kind of engaged with President Trump who may find your message very compelling. Tell us more.
Well, one, of course, 1 out of 10 of the supporters of Donald Trump actually supported my very dear brother, Bernie Sanders. You know, I supported Bernie Sanders twice, 2016, 2020. And he had the same critique of Wall Street that I have. He didn't have the same critique of the Pentagon that I have. But he's very progressive. And it means then that those who support Trump, you know, they're not stereotypes. They're human beings who are deeply wounded, deeply pushed against the wall economically, but they choose to follow a neo-fascist Pied Piper rather than understand their condition in such a way that it creates a class solidarity across race and across region. So I'm going straight into Trump country and try to convince them that their major political foes actually are the 1% echoes of the Occupy movement. And you know, of course, 3 individuals in the United States have wealth equivalent to the bottom 50% of Americans. That's 160 million And the top 1% have wealth equivalent to the bottom 90%. So 60% of Americans are struggling every day to survive. And yet it's the richest nation in the history of the world. And yet it's got military expenditures that are more than the next 10 countries combined. It's got 800 military units all around the world for its empire. And there's no way that poor and working people can be empowered given this kind of arrangement of an empire. So that's where the real effort needs to be. The truth-telling on the one hand, the organizing on the other, and then trying to do it in the spirit of love, Bill Feather. This is the challenge. You know what I mean? That's the real challenge. How do you talk about Israeli-Palestinian situation without trashing Jewish brothers and sisters? I have no time for any anti-Jewish hatred. I only have time for affirming Palestinian dignity and affirming Jewish security, but Jewish security does not go hand in hand with an Israeli occupation. There will never be Jewish security with an Israeli occupation and domination of Palestinians. How do we engage in this in such a way that we get beyond hatred and revenge, but put love and put justice, and most importantly, put the suffering of the least of these? As you know, I'm a revolutionary Christian, so the 25th chapter of Matthew means much to me. What you do to the least of these, the poor, the oppressed, the subjugated, you do unto me. I take that very seriously in terms of a calling.
But you also have the first woman of color essentially in the White House as Vice President of the United States. And so I'm just asking, has she delivered for the communities you're talking about? I mean, I'm interested in your view because a lot of people point to Kamala Harris and they say that's a sign of success. Does it feel like a sign of success?
Well, no. I mean, the same thing was true with Obama when we had a black president. You had a black president, you had a black attorney general, you had black homeland security, but you got a Black Lives Movement. Why you had militarized police departments, just like you got militarized apartheid-like conditions on the West Bank and Gaza, that the a presence of a black face in a high place symbolically shows a certain breakthrough, but substantially doesn't mean too much if they don't have the courage to critique the status quo that they're a part of. And so Kamala Harris just last year or so, when Biden was asked whether America was a racist society, he said no. And they asked her, is America a racist society? She said no. So she's just following her boss. She's not interested in truth. As I said before, if you can't allow the suffering to speak, you're not speaking truth. We got mass incarceration. My God, 25% of all incarcerated people in the world are the United States, most of them black and brown. Deeply, deeply white supremacists in that way, an extension in many ways of the slavery of 244 years in the Western Hemisphere and Jim Crow and Jane Crow another 100 years. So you have to be free enough to speak the truth, not in the spirit of self-righteousness, but in a spirit of self-critical, tenacious commitment to the overcoming the plight and predicament of poor and working people around the world. It reminds me of Ida B. Wells Barnett. That's my tradition. It's a great tradition of a black people that says in the face of terror, we don't terrorize back. We want liberty for everybody, but we will fight. In the face of hatred, we will still love truth and beauty and justice and organize in order to attempt to overcome. In the face of trauma, we'll be wounded healers rather than wounded herders. That's the great tradition of struggle for black freedom in the United States. And this campaign is just a small wave in that great ocean of that grand tradition, my brother.
In your campaign launch video, Dr. West, you reference your concern about the destruction of American democracy. I'd love to hear more. What is driving that destruction of American democracy from your view?
Well, we got neo-fascism escalating. What is neo-fascism? It is the rule of big military, big money, with political leaders who convince a relatively helpless citizenry that they should scapegoat the most vulnerable, indigenous people, black people, Muslims, Arabs, immigrants, Jews, any group that historically has been degraded. And that's precisely what Trump does. And you cannot have a democracy with the rule of big money, with grotesque wealth inequality, with hardly a public sphere, which means everything is commodified, ends up being militarized, ends up being privatized, So there's no public spaces where people can come together and engage in critical reflection. It's simply gangsterized, simply polarized. And the result is what? Tyranny, increasing tyranny. That's what we're seeing in the United States. And that's why it's so important to keep alive the great legacies of Martin Luther King Jr., Fannie Lou Hamer, and others.
You know, next week, the Supreme Court is supposed to rule on affirmative action. And I'm interested, if they strike down affirmative action, do you worry about that? Or is that basically a small measure when it comes to the level of systemic change you're advocating?
Yeah, I mean, my expectation is they certainly will. They'd already diluted it down to very narrow conceptions of diversity. It no longer has anything to do with the kind of call for reparations that are needed in order to begin to deal with the damage done of slavery and Jim Crow and Jane Crow and other forms of domination. So my hunch is they certainly will eliminate affirmative action, and we simply have to continue our struggle and try to come up with ways in which Black people, but not just Black people, but brown people, not just brown people, indigenous people, not just indigenous people, but poor people across the board, have ways in which they gain access to resources and dignity. So we simply have to shift in strategies that my brother, the Supreme Court, deeply conservative, deeply right-wing for the most part.
More to come from Dr. Cornel West. Thanks for listening this week. We'll check you out next week here on Ebony Spectrum. Take care.
Sunday morning brings the dawn in. It's just a restless feeling by my side. Early dawning Sunday morning, it's just the wasted years so close behind. Watch out, the world's behind you. There's always someone around you who will call. It's nothing at all. Sunday morning, and I'm falling. I've got a feeling I don't want to know. Early dawning Sunday morning, it's all the streets you crossed not so long ago. Watch out, the world's behind you. There's always someone around you who will call. It's nothing.
The University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio. This is In Black America.
I'd written an op-ed in the Houston Chronicle, and one of the readers saw my article, read it, and asked if I would go to the prison system and evaluate his Skills for Life program, which is similar to Toastmasters program, and give him feedback and seeing how the inmates would be able to improve their communication skills to transition from the prison system back into society. And I agreed to go and evaluate his program because I was in American Leadership Forum, and one of my assignments was to put myself in the place of another person.
Tammy Lane Campbell, founder and executive director of Honey Brown Hope Foundation. Founded in 1991, the Honey Brown Hope Foundation is a nationally recognized, award-winning 501c3 nonprofit that plants seeds of hope from the schoolhouse to the courthouse and the jailhouse. Campbell is a revered activist who has made the leap from rural Mississippi to become a nationally recognized civil rights leader. The foundation offers programming, resources, and support that align its causes, civil rights, diversity appreciation, and environmental stewardship. Little did Campbell know when she accepted that invitation to evaluate the educational program in the Texas prison system, she would meet Jarius Elam, a man convicted of aggravated robbery in 1984 after he was arrested for an altered credit card and driver's license that a co-worker tried to use at a juice store. I'm Johnny L. Hansen, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, the case of Jarius Elam with Tammy Lane Campbell. In Black America.
Jarius, in 1983, was a black college student at Texas Southern University, a member of Alpha Phi Alpha fraternity, a young man, married and committed, father of four. But despite having no criminal record and no evidence linking him to the crime, he was convicted of aggravated robbery, of a white man who was found dead with a gunshot wound to his head on the campus of Rice University in 1983. So, with that being said, this is an egregious case where Jarius has been denied justice for over 40 years.
In 1979, Jarius Elam left Chicago for Houston to attend Texas Southern University on a track scholarship. For 40 years now, he has languished in a Texas prison for a conviction many believe are based on lies and a bogus piece of evidence that has since been destroyed. In 1984, Elam was convicted of aggravated robbery after he was arrested for an altered credit card and driver's license that a co-worker tried to use at a shoe store. The credit card had been stolen from a man who had been found dead. With no DNA evidence and a false confession from a jail informant, he was locked up for a crime suspect at best. Born and raised in Chicago, Elam was the fifth of 11 siblings. He graduated high school in 1978 and earned a full scholarship to Texas Southern University, a historically black college and university. In January 2005, Campbell wrote an op-ed piece for the Houston Chronicle newspaper. That piece led her to meet Jarius Elam. In Black America spoke with Tammy Lane Campbell.
The Honey Brown Hope Foundation is a 501c3 nonprofit. We are nationally recognized. We promote an appreciation for the environment and for civil rights. Specifically focusing on post-conviction investigation and making sure that our people are given a fair chance in this criminal justice system.
So how long have you been involved in this crusade?
I have been involved for over 30 years, sir.
And what initially got you to become involved in this type of endeavor?
Well, what initially got me involved was a personal incident that happened to my child in kindergarten. And he was profiled by a police in kindergarten who was dating the principal and for standing up for his rights. And he felt that he had been mistreated because he was the only one told to go to the back of the line. He and two of his white classmates were running in the hall. And he took a stand, John, and his stand was he refused to sit in kindergarten style. And because he refused to sit in kindergarten style, the principal called her then fiance, who she married later, to remove him from the class. This DARE officer body slammed my baby and dragged him out of the class. So that is what initially got me involved. I became the president of our local NAACP and trying to not only protect my son and my daughter, but other children. And it was imperative and still is, that's one of the issues that we address as well in our civil rights initiative, is derailing the school to prison pipeline. Our children are set up in kindergarten for the school to prison pipeline. And when you consider how many jail cells are built based on the number of students who aren't able to read and write right by the third grade level, then you know that it is a cash cow for to really send our children to alternative school and to profile them at an early age and tag them for the criminal justice system.
Now, we met at the National Convention of the Urban League a couple of weeks ago, and you brought to my attention the case of Darius Elam. Talk to us about that, and I want to ask you some specific questions on it, but why is this particular case dear to your heart?
This particular case, as with other cases that are dear to my heart because it was a God-appointed case, I had, I would say, no inkling that I would meet Darius, let alone to be advocating for him. I had written an op-ed in the Houston Chronicle, and one of the readers saw my article, read it, and asked if I would go to the prison system and evaluate his Skills for Life program, which is similar to Toastmasters program, and give him feedback and seeing how the inmates would be able to improve their communication skills to transition from the prison system back into society. And I agreed to go and evaluate his program because I was in American Leadership Forum, and one of my assignments was to put myself in the place of another person. And I was also serving on serving as the chair for the criminal justice reform for DA Milliton, Brian Milliton, who is our first black DA in Fort Bend County. So all of these things were rolled up in one for me to, for God's appointment for me to get to Darius. As I visit the prison, I evaluated the program, and as the residents, I call rather than inmates, prisoners, were leaving, and they were giving me their feedback in terms of what I had conveyed to them. One of the residents said to me, "Miss Campbell, do you see the man at the back of the line? He doesn't belong here. He's innocent." And with that kind of referral, recommendation, you know, it is quite difficult to get another resident that is incarcerated to give that type of comment about a fellow resident. So from there, as he came through the line and I told him that one of his colleagues had shared with me that he doesn't belong there and that he was innocent. Well, at that point, Darius was, you could visibly see the tears in his eyes, and he requested me, he said, "Ms. Campbell, I am innocent, and if there's anything that you can do to help me, I would greatly appreciate it." And he gave me the contacts of his family members. And from there, I've been fighting to get justice for him and freedom, which that is justice for Darius Elam for right at 3 years. So Darius, in 1983, was a black college student at Texas Southern University, a member of Alpha Phi Alpha fraternity, a young man, married and committed, father of four. But despite having no criminal record and no evidence linking him to the crime, he was convicted of aggravated robbery of a white man who was found dead with a gunshot wound to his head on the campus of Rice University in 1983. So, with that being said, this is an egregious case where Darius has been denied justice for over 40 years. And he was initially charged with murder. When the Harris County District Attorney's Office they didn't have the evidence to convict. They changed that to aggravated robbery. Now, I'm going to tell you what happened. This man who was the victim, who was found on Rice University campus, dead. We're going to have to go back just a little bit. Initially, when Elam was arrested, he was charged with credit card fraud because he had given not an associate, but a person that he had met at TSU a ride. He was at work at the Galleria and saw this young man. And the young man came into the store where he was working and asked him if he would give him a ride home, and he agreed to do so. And as they were leaving the mall, he said, well, I want to stop by this other shoe store because I'm looking for a specific pair of shoes. And Elam agreed to do so. And as he was waiting for him, Elam was just browsing around the store, and he saw him looking at a pair of shoes, and he said, well, would you like those shoes? And Elam told him, yeah, but I'll pay you back when I get my check. And when they went up to pay for the shoes, the person that he had given a ride, unbeknownst to Elam, used the victim's credit card and driver's license. And he had imposed his picture over the driver's license. Now, John, this is the thing. Now, the person who had the driver's license was black, and he had imposed his photo over this white man who had not been discovered as dead at mm-hmm. the time. But the cashier saw the discrepancy and called security.
Exactly.
And when security was called, the person that had given the ride yelled to him to run, but Elam didn't run. Now, Elam was on a track scholarship at TSU. He could have outran those security officers if he had chosen to, but he did not run. And the cashier told him, well, he's not the one. It's the other person who was using the driver's license of this person, which they thought at the time was just credit card fraud. And that's how he was arrested for credit card fraud. But very suspiciously, the person who actually had the deceased man credit card and driver's license, which was discovered 2 days after this event, only got 5 years and was convicted of credit card fraud. But Elam charges were upgraded to murder initially, and then when they couldn't make that stick, it was aggravated robbery. And so that's why he was arrested, charged, and convicted.
This is In Black America. We'll be back with more of our conversation in a moment. Now, Ms. Campbell, in reading over Mr. Elam's story, I understand that the investigative detective searched the crime scene for Mr. Bolden, who was the individual, Richard Bolden, who was the individual that was murdered. Found no evidence or DNA evidence of Mr. Elam being at the crime scene. But then 90 days later, I understand, allegedly, that a yellow sheet of paper was found with Mr. Elam's blood on it that hadn't been previously noticed from the investigators prior to that. Talk to us about that.
Yes, most definitely. As you said, the everything else that initially was logged in to evidence, and that was, I think, a bullet, a piece of paper, and this was little balls of paper, and shoes, clothing, fingernail clipping, hair, and blood samples that was found on the passenger side of the victim's car. Now, when the DNA was done on those original evidence, the DNA excluded Darius Elam as a contributor to the crime. 90 days later, another investigator, HPD officer Leonard Cooper, supposedly found a yellow sheet of paper on the same side as the other evidence were found 90 days after the event. Now, this is very suspicious because anytime an evidence site is investigated, you have three investigators who logged off and documented everything that was at that crime scene. And in addition to that, you had photos, a photographer that came out that took pictures of everything. No yellow sheet of paper was found. 90 days afterwards, supposedly after the car was in lockup in the barn at HPD, the yellow sheet of paper with a blood spatter, supposedly of the victims, was found on the yellow sheet of paper. Now, let's back up a little. That yellow sheet of paper was when Darius was apprehended. Well, he had his notebook and everything with him in his briefcase. So he had a yellow tablet and everything. So what we believe is that that yellow sheet of paper was taken from his notebook, because why would you have just one sheet of paper that was found? And in addition to that, John, this is what is so suspicious, is that every piece of evidence that was found at that crime scene was kept by the county clerk, except for that yellow sheet of paper that was destroyed. Mm-hmm. Now, you know that is some kind of suspicious.
Now, Ms. Campbell, I also understand that there was some jailhouse informants involved in this case?
Yes, there were some jailhouse informants and HPD informant that I had demanded a post-conviction investigation and demanded HPD to do a post-conviction investigation. And as they were doing their investigation, they contacted their informant and asked him if he remembered the case. And he said he remembered the case, but he fabricated the whole story. He said, "I lied. That man never told me that he killed the victim, Mr. Bodum, or anyone that Richard Bowen. I'm sorry, Richard Bowen, that was the victim's name, anyone. And I just want to do the right thing." And so I never, it was it was some time that passed, HPD never told me the results of the investigation that the informant had told them, their informant had told them that he lied. He made the whole incident up of Darius telling him that he had killed the victims. And so at that time, I got into super mode, and God instructed me what to do, and we were able to hunt down this informant who had 8 different aliases. Mm-hmm. But our investigator was able to hunt him down. Once we hunt him down and got, well, even before then, how I knew about the informant called me and told me that HPD was putting pressure on him in reference to Darius Elam case, which he had informed HPD that he never heard Darius admit to killing anyone, and that they had told him, well, he could be charged with aggravated perjury. He said, but I want to do the right thing. And I said, well, I'm going to secure an attorney for you to go in to HPD because he was very frightened. And the next day I called him and told him we had secured the attorney. He had agreed to give an affidavit, and but she was out of town, and took about 3 days to get back because she was in California on another case. And by the time she had gotten back, she had gotten back. He had ran scared, and ran scared, and called me and told me he didn't want to speak to anyone about it, you know. So to not call him, even reference him in reference to that case. Now, I remind you that he was the one that called me and had agreed to give me an affidavit, but I told him I'd stay in my lane, the reason I got an attorney for him. But as I said, what we did is we got a hearing on the case December the 7th of 2022, and which was last year, and was trying to get the truth out of him, thought that he would tell the truth in court, but he by that time indicated on the witness stand that he didn't recall talking to me, talking to HPD Sergeant Rodriguez, who he had initially recanted, and we served the HPD Sergeant Rodriguez subpoena as well to testify. So when, you know, he gave his testimony in terms of the informant recanting his recanting his original testimony of 1983 that he had heard Darius Elam admit to killing the victim, and everything that was, you would think, was solid evidence in terms of this informant getting on the witness stand line. I had also witnessed that he had called me and contacted the foundation in reference to him making that story up about Darius Elam. And to our surprise, Judge Josh Hill and the special prosecutor from Brazos County indicated that they felt that this informant was a reliable witness when he got up on the stand. And first, he denied ever speaking to me or remembering speaking to me or to the sergeant. And then he said that he never spoke with me. Well, we had all the evidence, the text message, of course, his contact information, where he, it was apparent that he had spoken with me. And then you had HPD who had reached out to him. But the Texas Court of Criminal Appeal upheld the original verdict of guilty from the lower court, and Josh Hill's recommendation to the Criminal Court of Appeal and the prosecutor from Brazos County both recommended to the Texas Court of Criminal Appeal to uphold the original verdict. But we did get one judge to, he abstained, and when you abstain, that means you're not in agreement with the other judges on the case. He dissented is what is the proper word for it. And it was Judge McClure. And he was the only one that dissented on Darius' case.
Now, Ms. Campbell, moving forward, what are the options that Darius has before him currently, if at all?
Well, moving forward, thank you for asking, John. What we are trying to get and what we initially was trying to get with the case with the informant is for Harris County DA and Brazos County DA Jarvis Parson and DA Kim Ogg here in Harris County to offer the informant immunity for a truthful testimony.
Tammy Lane Campbell, founder and executive director of the Honey Brown Hope Foundation. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and X. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's americanarchives.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O'Hanson, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.
And folks, in the news this week.
On Sunday, human rights activist Cornel West addressed a crowd in front of the UN. He stressed that support for Palestinians does not mean hating anyone else.
And don't let anybody tell you that because you love Palestinians and Palestinian babies, that you hate somebody else. It just doesn't follow what our brothers are. We don't hate Jewish brothers. We don't hate Jewish sisters. We don't hate Jewish siblings. We loathe, we hate a vicious Israeli occupation.
Well, Cornel West is a philosopher and political activist, also an independent presidential candidate for 2024. And he joins us now here on Al Jazeera Live from New York. Good to have you with us. I find it interesting, Cornel, that when you say you support the Palestinians there, you felt that you also had to highlight that it doesn't mean you hate Jews. Is the debate so polarized there that you need to make that clarification?
Oh, absolutely. You see, I come from a great black people, been terrorized, traumatized, and hated for 400 years. Jews themselves have been hated, terrorized, and traumatized for 2,000 years. Palestinians have been hated, terrorized, and traumatized by Israelis for 75 years and more. So you're dealing with two groups
that have been hated, terrorized, and traumatized. And you have to be clear that it has nothing to do with anti-Jewish hatred when you talk about love of precious Palestinian brothers and sisters who are undergoing a barbaric genocidal attack and assault on their bodies, on their dignity, on their humanity. And it's so easy for the Israeli government, it's so easy for right-wing conservative folk in the American society and empire to accuse me and others of being anti-Jewish simply because we love Palestinians. I make that very clear, but it won't stop our commitment. It won't in any way dampen our fire. We want our Palestinian brothers and sisters to know we care for you, we're concerned about you, we're raising our voices, we're hitting the streets, we go into jail. And if the United States government that is shot through with its moral bankruptcy, its spiritual obscenity, and its criminality doesn't hear us, then we are going to oppose our own government.
What good, actually, at the end of the day, does that do, coming out and saying that you support Palestinians? How actually can you make any changes to the situation that the people in Gaza are facing right now?
Well, one is put pressure so that we have both a ceasefire, we have an exchange of hostages and Palestinian political prisoners and those who are detained in Israeli jails, and then the end of the siege and the end of the occupation that gets at the very source and core of this whole situation. And in addition to that, my dear sisters, it's also a matter of one's own personal integrity. How do we live in such a barbaric world and have some sense of morality and spirituality? How do we remain committed to justice and love, not hatred and revenge, but justice and love, given the overwhelming grimness of this situation that we see with our precious Palestinians having to undergo this kind of barbarity?
How are you using your platform now as an independent presidential candidate to boost your message?
Well, one is we have to shatter the lies. There's been attempts to rationalize and justify Israeli occupation, Israeli subjugation, Israeli degradation, and we have to be critical of our Palestinian brothers and sisters. If they're engaging in killing innocent people, those are war crimes. I'm critical of that. If they're degrading Jews, if they're anti-Jewish, I'm critical of that. But I'm keeping track right now of the structures and the institutions. And as a candidate, I want to rise above the hatred, rise above the revenge. And part of the legacy of Martin King and Fannie Lou Hamer, Rabbi Heschel and Edward Said is what? To accent justice. To accent justice. What does justice look like? Equal dignity, equal rights, equal access to resources of Palestinians and Jews in that region of the world.
When you look at the Democratic Party right now, what do you see? Do you see a party that has these values, or do you see the divisions? I'm thinking particularly of the silencing of Rashida Tlaib. She's the only Palestinian-American in Congress, and she was silenced recently when she was trying to speak up on these issues.
Yeah, well, I stand with my dear sister Rashida very much so. But no, when I look at the Democratic Party, I see bankruptcy. It's ethically bankrupt, that it's willing to enable genocide. The Israeli government willing to enact it, U.S. government willing to enable it. We have to be very, very clear. We have to be very, very honest. We have to be candid, and we have to speak very, very fearlessly. And unfortunately, we even have a whole wave of Black leaders who are so scared and intimidated and afraid of AIPAC. They're afraid of the Anti-Defamation League. They're afraid of any kind of pressures brought to bear on them so that they don't have their own status. Where's their commitment to truth? Where's their commitment to justice? What kind of integrity do they have? Can they put a smile on the face of Martin King and Malcolm X? Can they put a smile on the face of Ella Baker? Those are the moral and spiritual standards, and I want to be true to the standards of moral and spiritual greatness, which have to do with our common humanity, which have to do with our precious humanity. And that's the challenge right now in this moment of overwhelming grimness.
One that you are rising well to. Cornel West, many thanks indeed for taking the time to join us here on Al Jazeera.
Thank you so much.
What is also true is that the occupation and what's happening to Palestinians is unbearable. There are people right now who are dying who have nothing to do with what Hamas did.
That was former President Barack Obama weighing in on the brutal airstrikes that have been killing innocent civilians in the Gaza Strip, drawing attention to the unbearable deaths of these innocent Palestinians. Now, Obama made these statements during an appearance on Pod Save America. Here's more of what he had to say.
What Hamas did was horrific, and there's no justification for it. And what is also true is that the occupation and what's happening to Palestinians is unbearable. If you want to solve the problem, then you have to take in the whole truth. And you then have to admit nobody's hands are clean, that all of us are complicit to some degree. I look at this and I think back, what could I have done during my presidency to move this forward as hard as I tried? I've got the scars to prove it. But there's a part of me that's still saying, well, was there something else I could have done? That's the conversation we should be having, not just looking backwards, but looking forward.
Now, typically, when a former president comes out and says something that seems provocative or courageous, I'll be critical of them because it's like, hey, where was that courageous attitude when you were in charge? But to be fair to Obama, he actually had a notoriously frosty relationship with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu because he was one of the few presidents, American presidents, who was willing to demand that Netanyahu pump the brakes when it came to illegal settlements and when it came to any brutality toward Palestinian civilians. And he also bumped heads quite a bit with Netanyahu when he secured the Iran nuclear deal, which I'll give you more details about in just a moment. Netanyahu did not want an Iran nuclear deal. Netanyahu has always been thirsty for war with Iran, and of course not to fight that war with just the IDF, but to pressure the United States to involve its own military in that war. So here's a video just kind of summarizing some of the issues they had when Obama was in charge.
Analysts say President Obama and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu despise each other.
There's a fundamental sense of mistrust.
Former State Department insider Aaron David Miller calls the relationship the most dysfunctional ever. Each side thinking the other is ignoring their interests.
I think the president looks at Netanyahu. He doesn't feel that there's much respect for American interests. And the prime minister looks at the president and considers him bloodless and insensitive when it comes to really understanding Israeli needs.
Remember that supposed to be private exchange between the then French president and Obama in 2011. Sarkozy saying, I cannot bear Netanyahu. He's a liar. Obama responding, but I have to deal with him even more often than you.
But look, it wasn't just Obama who had deep issues with Netanyahu. So did Donald Trump.
You've probably heard that Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu, or Bibi as he's called, were best buds, that it was a bromance. Well, turns out that's bull. By the end of his presidency, Donald Trump couldn't stand Netanyahu. He thought Netanyahu was disloyal and ungrateful for everything he had done for him. By the time I talked to Trump in April 2021, he was over Bibi.
I haven't spoken to him since, man. I didn't talk to him.
That's right. Donald Trump said F him when it came to Benjamin Netanyahu. And one more clip that's really important, because Trump disclosed that he did not believe that Netanyahu was ever really serious about pursuing peace. Let's watch.
What a lot of people don't know is that actually in the first year of his presidency, and Trump told me this, his relationship with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas was very, very good.
And it was almost like a father. I mean, you know, he was so nice. Couldn't have been nicer. Now, the world and me, before I met with both of them, I thought it was the exact opposite. I thought the Palestinians were impossible and the Israelis would do anything to make peace and a deal. I found that not to be true.
And I find it very interesting and actually kind of surprising that, like Obama and Bill Clinton, Trump also came to the conclusion that Bibi was not sincere about wanting peace with the Palestinians.
I think he just tapped us along. They just tap, tap, tap. I don't think Bibi ever wanted to make peace.
I think Trump was right about that. I think Obama was right about Netanyahu's lack of concern with establishing a more peaceful environment between Palestinians and Israelis in that region.
Yeah, almost everybody who deals with Netanyahu thinks he's disgusting. One of the most immoral liars that the world has seen in a long time. So it's such a, look, as a lot of our world leaders are a scar upon our nations, like Trump was to America and Dick Cheney was to America and Bush and Erdogan, Turkey, Netanyahu, Israel, Putin, Russia. These are all stains on these countries. Is Putin, the bloodthirsty Putin, really a representative of the Russian people? I hope not. And I don't think so at all. Okay, and I don't think Netanyahu is a good representative of the Israeli people. Everyone loathes him for good reason. All he cares about is himself. He has no morality at all, and he's willing to kill as many innocent civilians as any terrorist. Let's be honest about it. Let's be honest about it. So he's now killed what, seven times as many Palestinian civilians as the leader of Hamas has. So those are facts. We say, oh, oops, it was an accident. It was an accident that I killed 10,000 civilians. No one thinks it's an accident. Only like people who are just obsessed with defending Israel, no matter what, would say that. No rational human being would thinks that all 10,000 civilians was just an accident, just collateral damages. We were getting the 13 Hamas guys. Okay, so one, I want to give credit to Barack Obama. I often criticize him for not coming out and making statements, being comfortable in his home. Oh, I'm an ex-president. Oh, I don't get to say anything, right? No. We could use your moral clarity from time to time. And here, credit where credit is due. Thank you. You see that now? Everybody's talking about what Obama said and how even Obama is saying, how many civilians are we going to kill? See, we need that moral clarity from time to time. So thank you, President Obama. Okay, now Trump, it breaks up into two different things. We covered that story before. Trump is bitter at Netanyahu for a lot of personal stuff, not backing him on the 2020 election, which is absurd. He thought he didn't thank him enough, etc. And on that one, though, that's only half absurd because Trump did everything for Netanyahu.
Yes, very true.
And he moved our embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, which Netanyahu wanted. He got out of the Iran peace deal, which Netanyahu wanted. He killed the top Iranian general. Netanyahu was thrilled about that. Trump almost started a war for Netanyahu, and Netanyahu still was like, who cares? Me. Okay, ironically, him and Trump are a good couple that way. They don't care about any other human being other than themselves. But the substantive things that Trump said, that's the second half, those are very real and very honest. And you heard it for yourself right there. Whether you love Trump or you hate Trump, there's no question that the second half of what he said is absolutely true. Netanyahu has never wanted peace. He profits from war. He profits from death. And he would rather, just like Dick Cheney here in America and on with all these different warmongers in these different countries, they think war and innocent people being murdered is helpful to my political career. So they have no interest in peace. Netanyahu has never wanted peace. He's a monumental liar. And the Israeli people should fire him immediately. And for God's sake, and for Israel's sake, let alone the Palestinians, do peace. Peace right away. Two-state solution instantly. That way the world can heal and the world can... Finally, wouldn't it be amazing if the world accepted Israel and said, okay, you're not occupying people anymore. You're not imprisoning and oppressing people anymore. Welcome to
to civilization.
And to the nations of the world that have agreed to certain moral rules. And Israel, to this moment, run by right-wingers like Netanyahu, say, no, we demand to oppress Palestinians, I guess, forever. Literally forever. We demand it. And if anyone disagrees, they're anti-Semitic. Yeah. That stuff's not working at all anymore. In the world, in America, anytime anybody says that now, it's a laughingstock, total joke. Oh, you're using that stupid old excuse? And by the way, it's such a sick thing to do because there's real anti-Semitism in the world. And it's a giant problem here in America. And then now you want to use it for political tricks so you can kill more Palestinian civilians? Nah, that's not going to fly.
Joining me now is Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Mr. Prime Minister, welcome back to Meet the Press.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
We really appreciate your being here. This is our first chance to talk to you since the horrific attack by Hamas against Israel on October 7th. Of course, now the ground offensive to eradicate Hamas is underway. Mr. Prime Minister, can you tell us how will you know when you have achieved your objective and how close are you to that goal?
We've set a specific target, that is to destroy Hamas's military capabilities and to destroy its governance capabilities over the 2 million people that it holds hostage in Gaza. That is something that we are achieving step by step, and I assure you we'll complete the task. If you want peace, destroy Hamas. If you want security, destroy Hamas. If you want a future for Israel, the Palestinians, the Middle East, destroy Hamas. We're absolutely intent on achieving it. And what I can tell you, Kirsten, is given the extraordinary performance of the Israeli army in the last few days, the last few weeks, we're going to achieve it. We'll do it with as few civilian casualties as we can and with maximum casualties on the Hamas terrorists, which we're achieving day by day, hour by hour. We'll complete the task. Victory.
Do you think it will take months? Will it take years? What should people be expecting?
I don't think it's going to take the time that it took the United States and the international coalition to defeat ISIS or to defeat Al-Qaeda. It took you many years. I don't think it's going to be many years. But I've set targets and not a deadline. And we're proceeding as quickly as we can, but also as carefully as we can, because we want to minimize civilian casualties and we want to minimize casualties on our side while maximizing the casualties on the of the Hamas terrorists. And we're actually achieving both. I would say the ground offensive that we began is actually reducing the amount of civilian casualties because the population, the civilian population in Gaza, is heeding our call to vacate the territories, the zone of fighting, get out of harm's way. Even though Hamas is trying to keep them in harm's way, we're succeeding in that. So the level of civilian casualties is coming down, importantly, and our military successes are coming up. That's important as well.
Let's talk about what's happening at Al-Shifa Hospital. There are reports that there's been a loss of power, which has caused the death of patients and even some infants. And I know that Israel has said Hamas is headquartered there. Even if that is the case, does that justify jeopardizing the lives of sick people and babies, Mr. Prime Minister?
No, on the contrary, we offered actually last night to give them enough fuel to operate the hospital, operate the incubators and so on, because we have obviously no battle with patients or with civilians at all. And I think every civilian death, every dead baby is a tragedy. But that tragedy should be placed squarely at the responsibility of Hamas, that is keeping its military installations inside hospitals, its command posts inside hospitals, inside schools, inside UNRWA, UN facilities, and so on. So we obviously don't want to give them immunity, but at the same time, we're sensitive to this issue. So we offered this help. They refused it. I've offered something else. I've said, let's build field hospitals. I asked the Emirates. I asked the French president, who sent a floating hospital ship. We've asked other countries to the UN, UNRWA, and so on, build field hospitals. Let's move the patients out of these Hamas command posts in the hospitals to these safe places. So far, they moved a few patients, not enough. I hope more will move. We're trying to deal with this as carefully as we can while not giving sanctuary to Hamas.
I just want to be very clear, though, on the fuel, because the Red Cross says it is ready to get fuel into Gaza, into these hospitals that so desperately need it, where lives depend on it. Do you have a plan to get the fuel in and to get the fuel to these hospitals?
Well, we just offered Shifa Hospital the fuel. They refused it. So they, you know, so the fuel to run the hospital. See, what happens is they want the Hamas that is hiding in the hospitals and placing itself there doesn't want the fuel for the hospitals. They don't give a hoot about the patients. They don't give a hoot about the civilians. Their spokesman said this. They said, Hamas is underground. Above ground, the civilian population, that's Israel's and the UN's responsibility. They don't care about the civilians. They don't care about the patients. But they want to get fuel that they'll take from the hospitals to their tunnels, to their war machine. the electricity they need to fire the rockets. They fire 10,000 rockets as we speak in Israel against Israel cities, and they continue to fight from those underground bunkers. So what we have to do is separate the two. We'll try to help those who need it in the hospitals, but not help the Hamas war machine.
Let's talk about the hostages. There are reports that there is a possible deal that would involve getting out women and children and the elderly. How close are you to reaching a deal to get more of the hostages out?
Well, Kirsten, I can say that we weren't close at all until we started the ground operation. In fact, we heard that there's an impending deal of this kind or of that kind, and then we learned that it was all hokum. It was nothing. But the minute we started the ground operation, things began to change.
So is there a potential deal, Mr. Prime Minister? Is there a potential deal?
There could be, but I think the less I say about it, the more I'll increase the chances that it materializes. And it's a result of pressure, military pressure, the extraordinary...
Hello, I'm DJ Firefly. It's time for Couch Dancing on WRCT Pittsburgh. We're starting off with Glow Phase and the tune Entwine Reprise. This is from the release Soft Gems. You should be able to see the whole playlist online at wrct.org.